content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the June 2025 Walter Magazine. We begin with Wild Ride, a world away from Raleigh, discovering the mountains of Kyrgyzstan on horseback, by Jesma Reynolds. It was the middle of the night, and I hadn't slept properly in a week. The glowing map on the seat back in front of me indicated we were about to skirt Syria to the south while crossing the Aral Sea. A couple of hours later, I witnessed the sun cresting over the eastern horizon, the same direction we were heading. I was 23 hours from home by plane, but hadn't even begun my journey, an eight-day pilgrimage by horseback across the mountains of Kyrgyzstan. I'd done a good deal of adventure travel post-college, backpacking through Thailand, India, and Nepal. Though I was now decidedly middle-aged, it was this continuing curiosity and longing to explore somewhere relatively untouched that led me to sign up for a horse-riding trip through Kyrgyzstan, something I'd read about during COVID and had earmarked in my maybe one day file. I knew little about its history, but it looked to be one of the prettiest and most remote places in the world. I enlisted one of my best friends, Noelle Moore, an accomplished equestrian who shared my inner anthropologist yearnings, to go with me. Once she agreed, preparations began in earnest. Our trip's host, Alexandra Tolstoy, the recently appointed tourism ambassador to Kyrgyzstan, and yes, a distant relative of Russian writer Leo Tolstoy, provided a reading list on the country's history and culture. An English citizen, Tolstoy had traveled the Silk Route on horseback with friends in the early aughts and has since been taking fellow adventurers on her own private trips to the country for the past 20 years. Noelle and I embraced this learning portion with gusto, devouring her list of books, videos, and podcasts, learning about this vast region and how empires shape history. In late September, departure day arrived. Noelle and I flew to London to decamp for a few days, where we fretted over the contents of our enormous duffel bags, which contained everything we could possibly need for 8 days in the wilderness. We then wrangled these mini dirigibles into a black cab to Heathrow, embarking on a 10-hour overnight flight via Istanbul to Kyrgyzstan's capital, Bishkek. We arrived early the next morning, excited and slightly disoriented, at Manas Airport, named for the country's national hero and legendary warrior. There we met up with our group of fellow riders, 13 of us in all, including Tolstoy. Our 45-minute drive into the city gave us time to absorb the landscape. The open steppe with vast fields gave way to small villages with traditional mud-bricked houses and the occasional mosque. Dogs roamed freely while commerce took place in open-air markets. Cows grazed in triangular patches of median between roadways and exit ramps. Even the sun itself cast a different hue than it does here in North Carolina, more diffused, as if the atmosphere itself conveyed its fascinating and mysterious culture. After checking into our hotel, we spent a day in Bishkek, a modern city with a population of over 1 million, whose brutalist buildings testify to its Soviet provenance. In the background stood the majestic, snow-capped Tian Shan Range, which spans into China, Kyrgyzstan's longest shared border. After spending one night in Bishkek, We traveled by bus for 11 hours through the expansive Suzumere Valley and several mountain passes, often sharing the narrow roads with shepherds on horseback, navigating herds of livestock down from their summer meadows to reach our first campsite. There we met our five local guides. These affable men were shepherds and beekeepers when they weren't escorting foreigners around, and most importantly, owned and cared for the horses we would ride for the next 8 days. Though none of our horses had names, we quickly grew attached to them, figuratively and literally. Our journey took us in and around the heavenly Sari Chelik Nature Reserve, a designated UNESCO World Biosphere that's an oasis of pristine lakes, verdant alpine meadows, soaring mountains, prolific fruit orchards, and one of the world's largest walnut forests. Victorian botanists collected early specimens of wild peonies, tulips, poppies, irises, and lilies from this Eden that are still favored in today's gardens. Traveling on horse proved to be an ideal way to see the land. The pace was fast enough to cover ground, but still allowed time to absorb the breathtaking surroundings. We typically rode 6 hours a day, broken up by idle 2-hour lunches, served bento box style by our hospitable guides, who also shared apples and plums foraged along the way. Each night was spent in a different location. A separate team of mostly Russians traveled ahead in a Soviet-era truck to set up each of our campsites. Arriving at day's end, we were greeted with freshly baked goods, relishing still warm powdered donuts with raspberry jam and hot tea, plus stronger libations for those ready to imbibe. Everything was placed on tables adorned with floral linens and vibrantly patterned Uzbek pottery sourced at the market in Bishkek. Tea time usually melded into dinner, which was prepared by our capable Russian cooks. There were soups and stews, handmade dumplings, and more meat than I've eaten in a decade. No one but went to bed hungry, just early. Our headlamps were usually shut off by 8:30 p.m. My new comrades and I couldn't believe how quickly the week passed, and none of us particularly wished to re-enter our busy modern lives. Of course, we missed our families, and a hot shower seemed like an incredible luxury, but we had all bonded over the extraordinary experience. On our last day at camp, we watched our Kyrgyz guides and Russian team exchange hugs and tears. Then we joined in, having bonded with our horses, the people, the mountains, and each other. This article was originally published in the March 2025 Walter magazine and was edited for Time. From the art department, without stopping, accomplished contemporary artist Juan Logan keeps creating by Liza Roberts. On a sprawling industrial site on the banks of the Catawba River, beyond a cabinet maker, a boat rental, and a rum distillery, past hundreds and hundreds of pallets of overstocked, shrink-wrapped big-box merchandise, lies a repository of an entirely different sort. Here, in an open, 5,000-square-foot space, stand sculptures and paintings, drawings, prints, and multimedia creations that address, mostly through abstraction, many of the issues of our time: race and memory, history and geography, stereotype and expectation, imagination and potential. This is the studio of the artist Juan Logan, the place where he creates and stores the work from a career spanning more than 50 years. He's one of our state's most accomplished contemporary artists, and one of its most prolific. In May, a major exhibition of his work, Without Stopping, Juan Logan, opened at the Mobile Museum of Art in Mobile, Alabama, where it will run until February 14, 2026. Featuring 48 works from Logan's decade-long Elegies series, including many never before seen in public, the exhibit will feature a massive new piece commissioned by the museum to commemorate the residents of Africatown, an area of Mobile founded by the descendants of enslaved people brought in 1860 to Mobile Bay aboard a wooden ship called the Clotilda. At 6.5 feet tall and 16 feet wide, Logan's commissioned piece, Elegy 186, Without Stopping, is by far the largest of this seminal series. I think of it as a series on memory, but not just mine, he says, collective memories. Though the word elegy often refers to a poem for the dead, it can also mean a serious reflection, Logan says. With abstract shapes and symbols, Logan reflects on the fragmented, imperfect, and haunting nature of memory, including cultural memories shared in various and ever-changing ways. A repeated image throughout his work over decades, beginning in the late 1970s and regularly appearing in his Elegies series, is the silhouette of a black head. The subtle shape shows up in painting, drawing, collage, and sculpture as a symbol of memory, loneliness, identity, and of the black experience. Other symbols that make regular appearances in Logan's colorful abstract work include starry skies, clouds, maps, and boats. Like a poet, Logan uses these allegorical images in individual works and as leitmotifs to represent many things: the collective unconscious, the workings of the world and the role of the individual in creating it, reserves of knowledge, the power of imagination and perception. Most important, Logan says, is not what he says these things mean or what his own point of view might be, but what they provoke or challenge in the viewer. Logan has been challenging viewers over the decades of a celebrated career that has seen his work shown across the country and around the world in solo and group shows. He has pieces in the permanent collections of some of the nation's foremost museums, including the Whitney Museum of American Art, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, the Baltimore Museum of Art, and Charlotte's Mint Museum. Wearing the uniform of black t-shirt and jeans that he has made his own for the past 40 years, the former University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill professor of studio art is a voluble host in his Belmont studio, eager to unpack the meaning and message of his work, which surrounds him in a vibrant, living archive. He does it through story. There's the story of a treacherous treadmill used to try to break the spirit of enslaved people in Jamaica in 1837. There's the story about the high school shop teacher who encouraged him to make his first work of art, an eagle carved in white birch. This is a man Logan is so determined to credit with launching his life's trajectory that he spells his name, Harold McLean. That's M-C, capital L-E-A-N. McLean told Logan that what he made didn't have to be like anyone else's. It can just be yours, the teacher said. The words unleashed something in Logan. It changed everything, he says. There's the tragic story of his father dying of a heart attack after a doctor didn't believe his chest pains were real. It's an example, Logan says, of racial bias, and one of his many inspirations for works that address injustice, oppression, and alienation. And then there are the many stories of home. The shape of a canted roofline in one of his works has him describing his own 114-year-old house, which was built by his great-grandfather and grandfather. It's a 10-minute drive from his studio in a neighborhood Logan illustrates with a quickly jotted map. Here's my house right here. Here's my mom's house over here. Here's my aunt's house here. There's another aunt here. Here's my sister's house. Here's my uncle's house down here. And then my grandfather's road that's named after him. The foundation of another house his great-grandfather built out of handmade bricks and lived in after slavery still stands in the woods nearby. These things serve to anchor you in a particular way, Logan says. I think more than perhaps other places, the South does that for so many people. For many years now, Logan says, I've tried to simply ask better questions. I think that's the only thing that allows us to deepen our investigations about what we're doing, regardless of discipline. If we can ask better questions, we'll learn more, be able to do more. Doing more is clearly not a problem for Logan. At any given time, he's got a dozen new projects in various stages underway. After the Mobile show opens, his work will be featured in an exhibit in Chattanooga in July and one on American and German abstractionists in Berlin in October. We want so much out of this life, he says, and we're here for such a brief period of time. So we try to do as much as we can, for as long as we can, with the hope that someone will take the time to preserve it and pass it on and share it with others. This article was edited for Time. Next, from the Nature Department, turtly awesome. Eastern box turtles are a native species with shells as distinct as thumbprints, by Mike Dunn. In all likelihood, you've been in this classic scenario. You're driving down the road and see a turtle attempting to cross. Do you stop? What I do is often dictated by the other circumstances. Is it a country road with little traffic or a busy highway? How far across the road is the turtle? How risky is it to try to pull over? There's not always an easy answer, but whenever it seems safe enough, I do try to stop. I'll pull well off the side of the road, turn on my flashers, and move the turtle to the side of the road in the direction it was traveling. That last part is very important. Unless it's unsafe to cross the road, place the turtle on the side of the road to which it was headed. They are determined little creatures. If you take them back to where they came from, they'll try to cross the road again. The most common species we, quote, rescue in our area is the eastern box turtle. They can typically grow to be 4 to 8 inches in shell length as adults and have a more highly domed top of the shell, or the carapace, than other species of local turtles. The bottom of the shell, the plastron, is hinged and provides the box turtle with its unique form of defense from predators. It can completely close the plastron like a tight box, leaving no part of its body exposed. The shell color of the eastern box turtle is variable, but usually is mostly brown with a yellow or orange pattern. Each box turtle has a unique carapace pattern, much like our fingerprints. Over the last few years, I've been photographing the shells of any box turtle we rescue or find while we're out walking. Of the 14 box turtles I've photographed in the past couple of years, within walking distance of our house, there have been only two repeats. That means we've had at least 12 individual turtles in the woods along our half-mile stretch of neighborhood road the past few years, which is a pretty good number, considering these turtles tend to have a small home range consisting of only a few acres. Mailbox turtles tend to have bright coloration on their skin and bright red or orange eyes, while females' eyes are usually brown. Both sexes have the shell covered with a layer of protective plates called scutes. The scutes show the distinctive colors and patterns of the turtle and are made of keratin, same as our fingernails and hair. Unlike many aquatic turtles, box turtles don't shed their scutes as they grow. Instead, the scutes continue to grow as the turtle does and form growth rings, much like a tree. The rings are indicative of periods of growth and not necessarily corresponding to years. Unlike what I'm experiencing as I get older, which is more and more wrinkles, a box turtle's shell tends to get smoother with age as the ridges get worn. Box turtles are active from spring through fall in our area. In winter, they bury themselves in the soil or leaf litter and enter a period of lower metabolic rate and inactivity called brumation. Mature females excavate a nest in the spring by using their hind legs to dig a small hole in the soil, then camouflage the nest by scraping soil and leaves over it. Females can store sperm for several years, giving them the advantage that they don't need to mate every year to produce offspring. They usually lay 2 to 6 eggs, which hatch in a few months, although some may overwinter and hatch the next spring. Eastern box turtles have a varied diet, including fruits, seeds, mushrooms, even ones poisonous to us, carrion, and many small invertebrates like earthworms, snails, and slugs. Another amazing thing about eastern box turtles is their longevity. It may take 5 to 10 years to reach sexual maturity, and they regularly live over 50 years. Some have even been known to live well past 100. Unfortunately, eastern box turtle populations are declining, due primarily to human activities, including collection as pets, casualties from vehicles and lawnmowers, and habitat loss and fragmentation due to development. Luckily, there are a lot of organizations trying to help these charismatic reptiles. Several groups in North Carolina, including Box Turtle Connection, Herp Mapper, and Neighborhood Box Turtle Watch, are doing long-term research projects monitoring box turtle populations, some involving the use of trained dogs to locate the turtles for study. And if you find an injured turtle, you can locate your nearest licensed wildlife rehabilitator for help. In the Triangle area, you can contact the Turtle Rescue Team at the College of Veterinary Medicine at North Carolina State University. According to their website, they received 471 eastern box turtles as patients in 2024 alone. The eastern box turtle was named our official state reptile by the North Carolina General Assembly in 1979. To help preserve this iconic species, please encourage people to slow down and be observant when driving and scan the road for turtles. If it's safe, give it a lift to the side of the road it was headed to, and please don't take them home or relocate them. Turtles have relatively small home ranges where they know the food sources and good places to spend the winter, and they don't do well in captivity. Let's help all our turtles live long and healthy lives in the wild. This article was edited for Time. from our town, Just Peachy by Addie Ladner. Did you know that only a single gene distinguishes a peach from its fuzz-free cousin, the nectarine? The nectarines could be viewed as a mutant of a peach, says Dr. Mike Parker, a tree fruit specialist and professor at North Carolina State University. Our state harvests nearly 4 million pounds of peaches a year, and NC State researchers and breeders have developed about 20 of the 40-plus varieties grown here. The Contender is one of Parker's favorites. This sweet, tangy, yellow-fleshed fruit is one of the first peaches to mature each year. The bright, big flavor just hits you at the first bite, he says. Others include the China Pearl, a white-fleshed fruit with a subtle flavor owing to its high sugar content paired with a lower acid, and the Carolina Gold, a bolder yellow-fleshed peach that's late maturing, meaning you can enjoy it deep in the summer. Much of NC State's research into peaches goes towards extending the growing season, since peaches have such a short shelf life. The best peaches come from local growers in the summer. Nothing compares in taste, says Parker. Find a list of local markets and roadside stands at waltermagazine.com. From the calendar, come June, North Carolina State University is the place to be for theater lovers. Theater Fest is a celebration of all things theater-related, from acting to scripts to props to lighting. Catch the romantic thriller Blithe Spirit June 12th through 22nd, or take a stab at being a writer or even an actor at Quick Scripts, a fast-paced evening of 10-minute interactive plays produced with audience participation on June 21st. The fun wraps up with the Theater Festival, a free gathering in Thompson Hall of crafts, music, and more. For ticket prices and times, go to theater.arts.ncsu.edu. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.